Today, a question of democracy with Senator Jared Rennick. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of this post covering finance and property news. Today, I'm joined by Senator Jared Rennick. Hi, Senator. Great to have you back on the show again.
Hi, Martin. Good to see you again.
Well, thank you very much for spending some time. And look, we spoke some time ago, and there are so many things that have developed since we spoke, but a couple of them were really interesting. We spoke about the pressure on regional Australia, specifically with branch closures. We spoke about the pressure of interest rates on households and what's that going to mean. And we also spoke more broadly about the effectiveness of the RBA and how it's been managing monetary policy and the implications for society. And I guess what I'd like to do, if you're okay, is to revisit some of those thematics and just get a bit of an update from you, because, well, things have moved on in some regards, but in other regards, maybe not as much as we'd like.
No, that's correct. Yeah. If anything, I think something's going backwards, but yeah.
Well, let's start with the RBA, because it seems to me that a lot of the issues that we've actually got in society at the moment are actually to do with what the RBA has or has not been doing. And I guess my first question is how accountable is the RBA actually for what it's up to?
Well, they're not accountable at all. They're an independent statutory body. One of the big cons of the last 20 years is that somehow these independent statutory bodies were going to improve the performance of the government. And I would disagree with that very vigorously, because I thought the whole point of democracy was all about making the people in government or the executive and the representatives accountable. But, you know, it's sort of been a sleight of hand. Well, you know, you can't really trust politicians, so we'll give it to bureaucrats instead. Well, at least you get the vote politicians out every 3 years. And, you know, as I say to people, if you join a political party, you can vote them out in pre-selection, which is what happened to me. But, you know, you get a lot more power inside a party if you actually join it, which for $110 a year, I say do it. But, yeah, the RBA, no one gets to kick the RBA out. They're appointed for a set term. And they generally swan off into the sunset, you know, regardless of the damage that they've caused. And in the case of Philip Lowe, he has caused an immense amount of damage. And, you know, it's like I've got lots of issues with COVID, but this whole idea of printing $300 billion and paying people to stay at home and do nothing after decades of being told that you can't print money out of thin air, how reckless it is to print money, et cetera, really sticks in my throat.
Yeah, and it's just worth interest. I think it really interesting that Michelle Bullock recently blamed effectively the start of the inflationary run on supply chain disruption post-COVID. I would argue that they are being very, very flexible with the truth there. The reason we had inflation was the term funding facility, the massive amount of liquidity that was printed, all of that stuff. That's where the inflation germ came from. And that actually is right back at the RBA's door.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They printed a heap of money. And I'm actually, as I say, what people need to understand is there's two ways to issue capital. You can issue bonds and you can issue equity, right? Now, so I'm not against, you know, issuing new capital. It just needs to be equity against what I call the Sovereign Seven infrastructure assets, right? But what these guys did, to ensure that the increase in demand that comes from the increased credit, you know, if you build infrastructure, then you get an increase in supply as well. What the RBA did was obviously increase the supply credit significantly, the amount of demand significantly by increasing, you know, issuing $300 billion in bonds. But they actually paid people to stay at home. So you had a massive increase in demand with offset by a massive decline in supply. So that is a recipe for inflation. You know, whereas I would argue that if you issued new bonds or issued new shares against infrastructure that increased supply, you would, you know, yes, you might increase demand, but you'd increase supply with it. So that your differential between supply and demand doesn't change. So you contain inflation. But what the RBA did was just obviously create inflation through the means I just described. But the other thing they did was too, they said they weren't raising interest rates, or gave the impression at least, because Philip Lowe likes to say he gave the impression it wasn't a commitment. But most people, certainly the media, were running around saying there wasn't going to be an interest rate rise until 2024. So that went, and even if Philip Lowe never said that initially, he should have certainly went out and doused the fire, but he didn't. Put out the fire, he didn't. He let that story run. So lots of people went and got, you know, new houses on a three-year fixed loan at 2.69%. And now, of course, all that's rolling off. We've now got the mortgage cliff where people are now rolling out on 6% loans. So that, over time, is going to hurt people a lot.
Yes, and of course, there are some financial stability implications of that because the banks are highly leveraged into the mortgage sector. The banks also, of course, got a massive amount of help from the RBA through the COVID period. And again, I just wonder to what extent that actually helped rather than hindered.
Well, it helped the banks a lot because, you know, $188 billion at 0.1 or 0.15% for 3 to 4 years was a great way to, fatten their wallet, so to speak. And look, you know, I spoke to Matt Comyn about this in the regional banking inquiry. And as he said, well, we did pass that on to homeowners. And he's correct, he did, but he was still marking it up by a margin of over 2%. So he's borrowing at, you know, 0.1 or 0.15, CBA or the banks are borrowing at 0.1, 0.15, and then lending it on at 2.69. So their markup was still, you know, 200% over 0.1%, you know, 15 to 20 times higher than what they were actually borrowing at. So, and some of that now, even, you know, what isn't lent, and some of that now obviously is parked in the overnight cash rate at 4%. It's a huge markup. And some of that, because it still doesn't roll off the last of it until next year, could be actually being used now on 6% loans. So they've, you know, I mean, and that wouldn't necessarily be the entire $188 billion. But, you know, yet again, they were bailed out. And this, you know, is not another example, as I say to my neoliberal colleagues in the Liberal Party, is because I'm a protectionist, as I keep reminding them that we were originally started off as a protectionist party, and even Robert Menzies himself says in the last paragraph of Forgotten People's speech, we should not go back to the old selfish notions of laissez-faire. But another example of how the so-called free market economy isn't really a free market economy, because these so-called private banks are always underwritten or backstopped by the taxpayer at the end of the day, as we saw in the GFC. As well as COVID.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, the international investors are assuming that the banks, the big banks in Australia, would get bailed out if they got into difficulty. That's one of the reasons why that they're rated the way they are. Now, you mentioned independence of the RBA, and I guess I got a couple of questions here. The first is, we know that the RBA is strongly connected to the Bank of International Settlements, and some of the communications and some of the issues that they discuss with the BIS are not really very public. You tried a few times in the various discussions you've had to get some information out from the RBA relating to some of those conversations. It's almost impossible. So there's a question of independence there with regard to the international banking system. And the other side of it, more recently, we've seen Jim Chalmers, for example, putting a lot of heavy pressure on Michelle Bullock not to lift for interest rates, when, again, you know, the RBA is meant to be independent. So there's a lot of questions about the structure of the RBA and the way it interacts.
What is it? The 1959 Banking Act, I think, says that the Treasurer can override the RBA. Some people think that's just, you know, a crazy idea that the Treasurer should override the RBA. The Treasurer sets the tax rate. So how is it okay to set the tax rates, income tax rates and company tax rates, but it's not okay to set the monetary, the interest rates, the price of money? I would have thought that controlling your currency was one of the key functions of a government and especially the Treasurer, and that ultimately, you know, and it's the Treasurer and the government of the day who has to pick up the tab fiscally. And I'll give you a good example there. When interest rates were on the way down, the deeming rates for the pension were too high at one point, where I think it was deemed that if you're a pensioner and you had $100,000 in the bank or whatever, you were earning 2 or 3% interest, when actually the interest rates went as low as, you know, 0.1, 0.2. So the deeming rates were implying the pensioners were receiving more. So those deeming rates had to be lowered, which then meant that the pension, more of the pension had to be paid out, fair enough, and that was fair enough to the pensioners, but that came at a fiscal cost to the budget. So yet again, I don't see why the Treasurer should be at the mercy at the mercy of the RBA, and we will see delinquencies increase, and, you know, there'll be greater pain and suffering, whether it's in rent subsidies or whatever, you know, there will be another fiscal response to what the actions of the monetary policy. So yet again, I think that as Treasurer, you should have control over the taxation and monetary system ultimately, because, you know, you're accountable to the people.
Right. So that suggests that the whole concept of the RBA being independent and they can go off and do things on their own bat, you know, is actually not really very much in line with reality, where in fact, ultimately, you know, well, there's somebody from Treasury actually on the board of the RBA in any case. So it's all sort of connected. And so sometimes I think that it's just a bit of an excuse.
But yet again, too, so when we talk about Treasury, yeah, they're responsible for the fiscal side of, and you know, often set the macro policy settings as well. They need to, so one of my big bugbears is we only use qualitative easing, i.e. changing the price of money on the first Tuesday of every month to control the economy, when we should be using quantitative easing as well as macroprudential measures. So yet again, people go, oh, quantitative easing, you mean printing money. You can't print money. That's really bad because it's going to cause inflation. Well, let's take our balance sheet. On the one side, we have an asset, and on the other side, we have what's called capital, and that can be either debt or equity. How is borrowing $1 billion, say, for example, offshore, and spending it, which increases demand, any worse than, say, issuing $1 billion in bonds to, say, an infrastructure bank that was owned by the people, issuing bonds to state governments to build it that was had to be secured against, say, a dam that was going to increase productivity, or had, you know, you issued $1 billion in bonds to build a power station that increased the supply of energy. So just strip it back to look at it through, we're going to run the government as a business. If we issue debt against an asset that produces an income greater than the cost of the debt or the equity, that's actually a good thing, isn't it? Isn't that what we really want to do? Because what we've got at the moment is the RBA's rapidly increasing interest rates, and I think the interest rates should rise, just not so rapidly. They should never have come down so much in the first place. But by rapidly increasing interest rates, they're actually driving down demand, which is only imposing austerity on the people. Why not try and increase supply through increasing productivity, which will grow the economy? And it's worth noting, and I haven't posted this yet on my social media, but I did ask the RBA last week about their method. Yeah, sure, they've destroyed demand or lowered demand, but they're actually lowering supply, especially in regards to housing, because there isn't a week that goes by now where a building company isn't collapsing. So we're reducing the supply of building when at a time we really want to increase the supply of houses and other sorts of building as well, mind you, infrastructure and all those other things that have to be built. So the government, the qualitative easing is just a blunt instrument that's just destroying the economy.
So it sounds to me as though a national bank is what you're actually advocating there.
An infrastructure bank. So yeah. Effectively, pass an act through Parliament that says you can set up an infrastructure bank that can issue, so you'll issue one share called Untapped Wealth, and then that one share will set up an infrastructure bank. The infrastructure bank then can either lead to the federal government or the state government across seven asset classes, and that will be dams, power stations, road, rail, ports, airports and telecommunications, and that's it. So the only time you can expand your balance sheet or do quantitative easing is against those what I call sovereign assets, which will generate a rate of return. And then that rate of return, you know, whether, if say, for example, the state government earns whatever, they can just pay back their bond over 100 years and the interest at 1%. The money that the infrastructure bank makes can either go back to the federal government in retained earnings, or, and this is how I would structure it, then the infrastructure bank can lend against other community service assets. So maybe to councils who have to build local roads. And that won't come from quantitative easing. That will just come from the retained earnings of the country, you know, through that 1% interest to, you know, help develop other assets as well.
Absolutely. Well, we definitely need a different strategy because the neoliberal philosophy of leaving it to the private sector and, you know, letting all of that work has not done well for the average Australian. And I guess you could actually, taking on this discussion now into the regional banking inquiry, you could argue that actually the neoliberal philosophy and, you know, let the profit rule is one of the reasons why regional banks are disappearing left, right and centre. And you've had now these hearings out in the bush. Was it worse than you expected to find?
Okay, can I come back to that question? I just want to take you up there. Neoliberalism is actually nothing but hypocrisy because the so-called neoliberals of the last 30 or 40 years said nothing as superannuation, or what I call wage theft, was imposed on people via superannuation, right? So this infrastructure that was so-called privatised into the private sector, into the private market, was not really privatised into the private market. It was actually privatised into two organisations, one, foreign bodies, foreign corporations, many of whom were state-owned. So, you know, you'll have the Chinese or the Saudis and, you know, and then other super funds. So superannuation funds are not the private market. Superannuation needs to be called out for what it is, which is blatant communism and morphing into totalitarianism. Because when you've got $3 trillion in capital, you can control industry. And when you control industry, you control media, because media relies on industry. Media relies on the industry for its advertising, right? So we now have, I think, $3.5 trillion in superannuation all up, about $2.8 trillion of that's controlled by industry and retail funds. Worth noting that Paul Keating never held a referendum in 1992 to, you know, where he went and said, well, by 2025, we're going to take 12% of your income, give it to someone you've never met, and you're okay with that. Pretty sure the referendum would have come up with a no, step one. And step two, people who have money in their retail or super funds or industry funds don't actually get to vote on who runs those boards. Those board members are selected, they aren't elected. So yet again, that undermines democracy. So we've now got communism in centralised wealth. You know, these industry funds have been these industry funds pushed down their Marxist values, and we saw that in The Voice, where companies were now wasting shareholders' money on you know, pushing ideological issues. You know, companies should be driven by productivity, not ideology. And then, of course, we've got the fascism side of it, where your companies are now so big, and these superannuation funds are so big, they're literally telling government what to do. So, you know, you combine Marxism, communism, and fascism all together, you get totalitarianism. So the so-called free market that many of my colleagues and the Labor acolytes like Hawke and Keating were sprouting, that's not really the case at all. We're told that it's free market, but no, our superannuation funds control our infrastructure along with foreign bodies, and we're not living in a free market at all, because I'm sorry, but the government has no right to take 12% of your income and give it to someone else in the form of superannuation. That is nothing but wage theft, and it needs to be called out for what it is. Now, back to the regional banking issue. Sorry, I just needed to put that out there, because it's a myth that the free market is what's been, we've been living in a free market. They use free market term, but they're actually misleading us when they say that. We've actually had more and more government control imposed on us over the last 30, 40 years. Ironically enough, because we sold all that infrastructure and then marched on into the family home, the classroom, the bedroom, the company boardroom, the doctor's waiting room, telling us how to live our personal lives, when that's not what the government should be doing at all. They need to get out of that. So regional banking, yes. So branches are closing down because effectively there is no backstop to private banks. Now, I'm a big believer the best way to regulate the private market when it comes to essential services is to have a backstop in the public sector. So health and education are also essential services. We have public schools and we have private schools. Public schools act as a backstop, and public hospitals act as a backstop to price gouging by the private sector. Not everyone can afford private health insurance. Not everyone can afford private schools. That's fine. We will set up a public system that provides, you know, a basic level at the very least. And I'd like to think our schools do better than that. You know, most cases they do. And I don't see why we should not have the same situation in regards to banking, whereby we have a public bank like we used to with the Commonwealth Bank. And combined with that, by the way, should be also a government insurance office that provides banking and insurance services to people, not just in the regions, but to metropolitan areas and in the city as well. Because I think, you know, it's interesting. They often refer to that, was it 2016 or 17, whichever year it was, you know, there was a Royal Commission into banking, but that was actually a Royal Commission into misconduct into banking, superannuation and financial services. So, and that misconduct came about because at the same time Keating privatised the CBA, and that was finished off by Howard, they introduced superannuation. So yet again, we've got these superannuation funds that, you know, their board members aren't actually elected. I suspect if you asked most people on the street what fund that they had their money in, probably 50% wouldn't even know it, and less than 10% would even know who their board members of that particular fund were. Now, obviously, the exception to that is self-managed funds, but here's the irony. The people that benefit the most out of superannuation are the people who have their money in self-managed super funds. But those people are smart enough to actually manage their own money in retirement anyway. So, you know, one of the, you know, and you'd know this, $50 billion in tax concessions for super, $30 billion in fees, still the same number of percentage of retirees on the pension today as there was in 1992, 50%. Part-time has come from part-time pensioner who get part of the pension has come down from 26 to 21, 20%. So, you know, a very small price to pay, and the cost of superannuation now for the top, who, you know, in terms of tax concessions, which mostly goes to the top 25% of income earners, is almost now as much as the cost of the pension, which goes to the bottom 75%. So it's just incredibly inequitable and destroys the economy in so many other ways as well, not the least of loss of money, et cetera. But so back to the banks again. So the banks have just slowly been closing branches on the and look, you know, they do have a valid reason in the sense that a lot more transactions are done online, and no one's disputing that. I'm not disputing that. I do most of my banking online, but, you know, I've got a home loan that's about to roll over, not a home loan, but an investment home loan that's about to roll over in the next week or so. You know, I want to go and see the bank face-to-face to negotiate a new home loan rate, right? So, you know, I want to go to the bank. Sometimes, you know, there's various reasons I may want to go to a bank. For people who are older people that aren't comfortable using technology, and many people have arthritis or other forms of dementia where, you know, they struggle to hold a phone properly to do internet banking or sit in front of a computer. You know, a lot of immigrants who can't speak English or aren't that comfortable with English don't always want to use internet banking. So, you know, and then you have the community groups that need to go and get their ID verified. They don't want to have to drive 150 kilometres if they're living in the region to do that. You know, small businesses or businesses in general still need to park, deposit cash overnight. So there's still a lot of, reasons why you need branches to remain open to provide services rather than, you know, rather than just transactional services, there's plenty of other types of services as well. The argument that the banks use that, you know, it's costing money and all that, well, I'm sorry, but most of the wealth in this country comes from the regions. A lot of those, in terms of cash deposits and that, a lot of these people deposit their cash in deposit accounts that offer very low rates of interest, which the banks then turn around and then lend out at 6%. So they're making whopping margins on these accounts where people use cash. So I just think they've got a social license. The banks, they've been bailed out numerous times, and we know that they'll be bailed out again. And they're using our money. The currency that they use, the Australian dollar, is backed by the Australian taxpayer. So they have an obligation to fulfil that social license and provide services to the regions. Now, do I think they'll do that? Absolutely not. And this banking inquiry will wrap up and, you know, I'll write a dissenting report. I'm going to call for a public bank along, you know, including, bank insurance, so banking and insurance services, because I don't think that, you know, any sort of, you know, punitive measure or trying to strengthen the banking code of conduct just won't cut it. The best way is to acknowledge banking is an essential service and that we should have public banks to provide banking services. And one of those services should also be, I think, is much longer-term fixed loans. I know in the States they offer, you know, long-term fixed housing loans of 20 up to 20 or 30 years. I've got a mate in the Netherlands who had, you know, a 30-year home loan. I don't see why a public bank couldn't go about offering a much longer-term home loan to take out all of this volatility with the RBA changing the rate of interest every month. I mean, I know you can lock in for 5 years, and I mean, there are some 10-year loans, but seriously, the amount of volatility in our money markets, you know, it only encourages speculation, really.
Absolutely. And a couple of thoughts there. Use of cash. Cash is more used in the regions than the cities, partly because the digital side is less advanced in the regions.
Yeah, yeah. And I should have added too, like if you're in the regions, not everyone gets access to Wi-Fi. So it's not always that easy to log on to internet banking as well. And then, you know, then you've got a phone reception because often they'll send you a code that you've got to then type in to finish the transaction off. So you both need Wi-Fi and satellite reception on your phone to be able to do both verification banking, so to speak. So, yeah, look, cash is probably used more in the regions for that reason. I'm just of the view that, you know, we just don't want to lose cash, period. I mean, it's hard to sort of, convenience is a very hard thing to argue against, and people are, you know, most people are going to use tap and pay. But, you know, for fares and things like that, you know, I don't think we're anywhere near getting rid of cash. And the big fear is once we get rid of cash as a form of medium of exchange and it all goes digital, then we start talking about social credit and the control that they can exert. You know, governments can exert, or the banks or organisations who have access to that financial data can exert over people.
Yes, and the central bank digital currency initiative, which is still running in the background there as well. Look, the fact is, of course, when the power goes off, cash is the only thing that works.
Yeah, yeah. And as we go more and more renewables, I'd be a brave man to suggest that, you know, if we get to 82% renewables, which is what the Labor Party would like to get to by 2030, you'd be a brave man to argue that at some point the power won't go off somewhere in that transition.
Absolutely. A couple of last quick questions. There's a bill currently which is potentially going to limit free speech, particularly on internet channels. Do you have a particular view on that?
Absolutely. And it is absolutely against it 100%. It's just, you know, who is the arbiter of truth? And it's certainly, you know, this is just fundamental. And I mean, I've been on the receiving end of this for the last few years. I just got fact-checked yesterday for doing a meme, and the fact-check was nothing, you know, what they said was in the meme was nothing of the description even in the meme. Totally against it, not the least because governments, universities and media, I think, are excluded. So in other words, the individual, the little guy, the battler, they're not allowed to say what they think, but, you know, so it's basically censorship. The proposed bill seeks to censor the individual, which is what I thought, you know, in a democratic society, you know, the government was meant to protect the individual from institutions, and actually protects institutions such as the media and universities and the government themselves from spreading propaganda. So, yeah, completely wrong. 100%.
Yeah, and of course,
and, you know, if your viewers are listening to this, I would, you know, if this gets up, I would be taking to task the crossbench senators and Labor, because, you know, they're the ones who are going, and it'll require the Greens to vote for it as well. And regardless of what your prior political views are, any attempt to censor free speech, you just should not tolerate.
Absolutely. Well, you know, who defines what truth is? If you're not careful, it's defined by the people who are in power at the top. And that means you can't have a consenting, a voice that's different. And of course, as you say, the small voices will get crushed, and truth goes out the window potentially.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. Oh, final question, Senator. You know, you didn't get re-selected, unfortunately. Part of that, I suspect, is because you sort of zigged rather than zagged vis-a-vis some of the main policies of your party. But I guess more generally, what does this tell us about the way that democracy works in Australia? And does the system actually support the interests of the people or not? What do you think?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, as I say to a lot of the people, I mean, you take November 21 in Brisbane, 30,000 people marched against vaccine mandates. There's 10,000 people in LNP in Queensland. Had those 30,000 people actually decided to do something constructive and protesting, I mean, you can do your protesting, but protesting is not constructive. You need to be in the boardroom during the weekdays, not out in the car park, in the CBD car parks on the weekend. And join the, you know, a political party, also the LNP, because, you know, I don't think Labor even conducts proper pre-selections. I'd probably still be a senator today. And ironically enough, one of the reasons why I lost was that certain party units didn't reach quorum. And that was because a lot of people left the party out of frustration with the vaccine mandates. And as I say to them, when you walk away from the political process, you're actually gifting the process to your enemies. So, you know, and that's why I haven't left the party. I mean, you know, I'd love to give the middle finger to some of the people in the party for, you know, not getting, you know, supporting me. But I'm not going to do that because that makes it too easy for those people that tried to get rid of me. So I'm hanging around. But, you know, my response is democracy is only as good as how actively people get involved. And sharing stuff on social media endlessly is not being proactive or productively proactive. So social media is a means to an end, and it's very useful for sharing information. But if you're just sharing information endlessly without actually actioning any of that stuff, you're wasting your time. So likewise for petitions, no one, you know, people all share our petitions. They ask me to post petitions all the time. I won't do it. Join a political party. The LNP up here is $110. You get to vote in pre-selections for your state and federal members. And, you know, some of our branches up here have 30 people in the state SEC. So, you know, your vote's worth 1 in 30 instead of 1 in 30,000. Likewise, in FECs, our biggest ones are probably 200 or 300, maybe 400 couple. But then there's others that don't have more than 100 in pre-selection. So your vote's just suddenly worth 1 in 100. And you can actually run as well. Now, a lot of people will go, you know, they've left and gone to a minor party. But my problem, and in some respects, I've been voting in regards to the vaccine mandates with the minor parties a lot. But, yeah, there's about seven of us. I mean, we just don't have the numbers. And as I say to people, stop sending me stuff on the vaccines don't work. I don't need to hear that. I know they don't work, or at least the COVID ones. I'm not talking about other vaccines. I don't need that. I don't need any more information. I actually need numbers. We need numbers. And, you know, when we walk away from the process, we are actually making the process work. Now, you know, and if you want to draw inspiration, draw it from our pioneering forefathers who arrived in Australia. They didn't throw the towel in after the first drought or the flood or the fire. You know, they got up and they got knocked over and got up again and kept going. And that's what we've got to do because too many people, you know, they'll join a party, they'll get upset and then they'll quit and leave. That is an emotional response. And it's, you know, as I say to people, you know, you'll be the same people that complain about our car industry closing down. Well, that's what the neoliberals did to our car industry. They said, we won't fix this, we won't make it better, we'll just walk away from it. And we walked away from a lot of our manufacturing because it was all too hard to compete with Asia. And I mean, I accept it is hard to compete with Asian wages and stuff. I'm not going to say it was going to be easy, but, you know, you don't give up when the going gets tough and throw the baby out the bathwater. And, you know, we need to do, we can't allow it happen to our political system what we did to our manufacturing system, whereas we just gave up, said it was all too hard. Different reasons, like, you know, but so, yeah. You know, so is our political system broken? Well, it's not. It's the power is in the hands of the oligarchs. So media, bureaucrats, superannuation funds, and the government. So we need to make superannuation optional, if not shut it down. We need to start paying childcare back to the parents and not the childcare centres. We need, you know, basically to restrain the authority of these institutions that just have way too much power. In my view.
Yeah, and I think the point that you make that it is up to the individual people, you know, to understand that there's a political process to be part of. If you just walk away from it or just throw rocks at it, then, you know, that's not going to help. You've actually got to participate. And, you know, we've been quite successful through the cash ban and through the regional, you know, inquiry into branch closures and things where we've actually used the system to be able to actually get stuff going. But that, of course, it's a lot of time, effort and continual pressure to be able to do it. But that is the way to actually get change to actually happen. And, you know, you've been a beacon for transparency and calling stuff out, Sandra, over the recent time. So thank you for that. And thank you for coming on the show again today. I'm hoping I might catch up with you again at least once more before, you know, your time. But even after that, you know, feel free to come back on DFA anytime because I think there were some really, really important issues that you've highlighted and will continue to highlight.
Cheers. Thanks very much, Martin. And yeah, always enjoy coming on here. And thanks for having me on. And good night to all your listeners.
Thank you very much, Senator. Take care. See you later. Bye. Okay.